Hi, Steve Cooper, and welcome to this Rank Success podcast. This is the introduction to an episode that I'm excited to share my platform on for the first time. And I'm sharing my platform with a serving detective inspector, Becky Davis, to address the topic of neurodiversity in policing. And in this audio podcast, Becky shares her story and experiences as an autistic woman in policing in relation to her career as a neurodiverse officer. And I believe that every aspiring leader and senior leader in policing should listen to this. Before we get into this fantastic episode, I've just a bit of an update. I've just got back from delivering a police promotion masterclass at the National Motorcycle Museum in Birmingham yesterday. And I'm increasingly speaking with and seeing more neurodiverse officers who self-disclose issues to me and who attend the masterclasses. And I'm used now to printing off materials in different colours by request and meeting the different needs of individuals as best I can in accordance with their needs, because no two people experience neurodiversity issues in the same way. So whilst it's limited, I'm always willing to support people, and I'm always happy and approachable to discuss issues before you attend. I've also recently written three blogs on neurodiversity in policing on policepromotion.blog. And I don't run many promotion masterclasses, but the next one, if you're interested, is on Saturday the 18th of March. And again, it's at the National Motorcycle Museum in Solihull in Birmingham. And you can book on via my site, ranksuccess.co.uk. And I look forward to meeting you if you can make it. At the time of recording this, there's still a £100 saving for early bird bookings. So something for you to consider if you're an aspiring leader. Alternatively, if you can't make it, then there's downloadable digital toolkits that you can download, including a 4-hour promotion masterclass and a 3-hour CVF explainer video. Okay, as alluded to earlier on, this is the first time that I've shared my platform. But if you're listening in and you'd like to reach thousands of officers and listeners across 40 plus countries, I'd like to invite you to write a guest blog, as Becky's done, on policepromotion.blog, or record a podcast with me to discuss a policing issue or leadership or promotion in the police service, or a controversial issue. Happy to discuss that. Please just get in touch with me. There's no paywalls, and there's lots of inspiring leadership tips and policing insights available. And for those of you listening in and you're aspiring promotion candidates, I've previously recently interviewed Assistant Chief Constable Una Jennings of Cheshire Police, Chief Constable Lee Freeman, KPM of Humberside, Chief Constable Chris Noble of Staffordshire, and former Metropolitan Police Commander Simon Foy, Queen's Police Medal, from the Metropolitan Police. And all of them have been very generous with their time to share their perspectives on police leadership and promotion and wider issues. And I'm very appreciative of that, very grateful. I'd also like to thank Becky for taking the time to write her blog in relation to neurodiversity and her experiences, and to record it for those who prefer to listen than read. And I'd encourage you now just to sit back with a coffee and listen to Becky's incredibly honest, open and transparent account of her experiences in her career in policing to date, and her struggles to fit in as an autistic officer, to be accepted, her experiences with her line managers and SMTs. She describes herself as a Marmite character. You either like her or you don't, and that applies to SMTs as well. She harbours no anger or bitterness as a result of her experiences, but for those reasons, and she's obviously got to Detective Inspector, and I find her story inspiring, touching, impactive and emotional. And as I said earlier on, I think it's one that every aspiring leader should listen to, and definitely one for senior managers and senior police leaders to include and consider in their policy and decisions around neurodiversity and getting the best from people and staff. So without further ado, here is Becky's story.
Imagine being in the dark for 38 years, never fitting in, feeling like Marmite to others, and knowing that you're smart, but often feeling really stupid. Well, that was me until 2021, when the penny finally dropped. Turns out I'm not a jerk, a loner, or stupid. I'm in fact actually autistic and ADHD. I joined policing age 20, but long before that, I knew there was something different about me. I struggled with social groups at school, especially groups of girls. And I felt some really strong, overwhelming emotions at times with no explanation. I now, of course, know that this is because the complex social world, especially that which the majority of the female gender operate in, is on the whole a complete mystery to me. The strong emotions and sometimes outbursts are the result of overstimulation in a neurotypical world. Things like small talk, eye contact and physical contact are alien to me. Like many autistic girls, I learnt to mimic and mask from a really early age. It's survival. But whilst it can get you through life and what appears from the outside world with relative success, there is a huge cost, both physical and emotional, and it's not thriving. From an early age, I developed symptoms of an autoimmune disorder that was diagnosed at age 25, and research has linked autism with autoimmune disorders. A significant proportion of autistic women also suffer with eating disorders. During my teenage years, I spent several of them starving or binging and purging. I knew for a long time that the eating disorder had nothing to do with skinny women in magazines. It was about control, so reframing it through an autistic lens makes total sense. It was at a time where the social landscape in which I was operating in as a teenage girl was becoming ever more complex and difficult to navigate. Undoubtedly, the significant neurological and biological changes within all teenagers' brains and bodies only served to amplify the effects. On top of that, I was dealing with difficult family dynamics. Everything in my life felt out of control. But there was one thing I could control, what I put in and out of my body. And the worse things got, the more I controlled it. The ability of autistic people to hyper-focus on something, including to the detriment of their own health, is at times alarming. Things got better when I started to incessantly exercise, age 15. But it remained one of the ways I managed the difficult stuff for 6 years until I joined the police. There's a lot about policing that suits a neurodivergent and helps regulation. Wearing the same thing every day, the routine, a certain amount of autonomy over decision making. There's also things though that make us vulnerable to the less desirable parts of a policing organisation. At 25, I was a divorcee and in a man's world, had become good at mimicking to fit in and try to avoid certain unpleasant behaviours. But like any other mimic or masking, it's a tactic prone to burnout and failure. Some of these behaviours were perpetrated by women as well as men, a phenomenon that actually feels more brutal than traditional misogyny. At age 24, I was bullied by a female sergeant. I'm now fairly certain my autistic traits had rubbed her up the wrong way and she became determined to stunt my career and humiliate me at every opportunity. My confidence hit rock bottom and I developed a fear of public speaking to the point I couldn't do it for a long time because I would dissociate. I had been up until then on the promotion pathway, having passed the sergeant's exam and acting up. But all that fell away with my confidence. It would be another 7 years before I stepped up again. At age 30, I had my first child, and the more acute comorbid mental health problems continued. Just a week after she was born, I was in an absolute mess, and another 2 weeks after that, I didn't want to be on the planet anymore. It wasn't long after I was ill that I could describe what it was about the early days that made me so poorly. But it was another 8 years and another baby later that I finally understood that autism was the issue and the acute anxiety, depression, comorbid conditions. I love both my children and I'd go through hell 20 times over to have them. But there's things about the early days that can be particularly challenging for some autistic individuals. The lack of routine and predictability puts me in an absolute spin. And both my children were in military precision routines by the time they were 12 weeks old. The inability to get any alone time to recharge and constant noise is like torture to the neurosensitive. It quickly got better once I gave into medication to cut through the acute anxiety the scenario created. Nevertheless, it was an entirely unpleasant and frightening experience for a while. I was recently asked whether knowing I was autistic would have made a difference. Whilst hard to say, I believe it would have made a big difference and made the acute periods of mental illness I have experienced entirely avoidable. However, I have no anger or bitterness about that. Had I not been through those awful experiences, I may not have gone on to drive improvement. Struggling with an eating disorder had ignited an interest in mental health, and postnatal depression set it alight. Especially when I came back to work and support was all but void for those returning from maternity leave, let alone those struggling with postnatal illness. This lack of support can undoubtedly stunt many women's careers as they struggle to adjust. I became deeply invested in improving the picture around perinatal, police and service user mental health. And this is where my autistic strengths came to fruition. My resilience and determination, my ability to spot patterns and gaps in service delivery and to plug the gaps with innovation. Between 2014 and 2021, I drove and co-delivered projects at local, strategic and national level. These included family support, men's health, perinatal mental health and neurodivergence in custody, and police mental health, working with NHS and third sector partners along the way. I used my own lived experience and the lived experience of others to ensure services were fit for purpose. Much of it's been adopted by other services and some of it published as national best practice. I felt like I'd proved my worth, my skills and abilities, but sadly I was still misheard and misunderstood by many. One of my autistic traits is a complete lack of patience in certain scenarios. If I decide something needs to happen, it needed to happen yesterday. That ability to spot gaps in service delivery and the solution at the same time. I assumed for a long time that everyone else could see what I could see and couldn't understand why I needed to gain buy-in when it's really obvious. One of my bosses eventually pointed out that others can't see what I can see, so I need to take the time to bring people along. I have to work at it and on the frustration it can bring. It's seen me get into trouble, alienate others and ditch projects along the way. Communication can also be difficult. I am brutally honest and direct. I don't intend to upset or annoy. I just don't know how to flower information up to be more palatable to certain people. I struggle with eye contact, both making and breaking it. I often need more time to process information in conversation, to work out whether people are using words in a literal sense or not, and give an appropriate response. I can't hide my emotions, and in fact, they can be amplified on my face. For example, mild disagreement can look like anger. A combination of all these factors can make communication difficult at times and lead people to take a really negative perspective of me without me having a clue at all as to what I did or why it went so badly. Around the same time I started taking on improvement work, I decided that to be the change I also now needed to get on with promotion. Despite the improvement work I'd done, I just couldn't get the support from my senior management teams at both Sergeant and Inspector. Eventually I worked out it was the Marmite phenomenon. Half the SMT would be saying I was the best thing since sliced bread and we needed more people like me in the organisation. Half would be saying absolutely not and that I was a loose cannon. Words like combative, arrogant and rude were assigned to me, linked to the aforementioned communication differences. But those in the other camp would frame those traits using adjectives like direct, passionate and driven, maybe appreciating the need for more of this approach in policing. More honesty, more openness, more transparency. It took me 4 years to achieve substantive promotion to sergeant. Not because I couldn't pass the CVF board, I passed the first one I got to, but because I couldn't get SMT support, as it didn't fit the right mould. The negative impact on my well-being and family life was significant. I had hoped that when I went for inspector, things would be easier. I'd had coaching and mentoring by then. I'd worked really hard to mask and dial down the parts of my personality that weren't palatable or desirable to certain people. But at the first temporary inspector's panel, it was the same thing. I then completed another round of 360 feedback, which told me that despite the attempts to fit the mould, I was still perceived in certain negative ways. During this time, I'd been supporting several women as a Police Federation representative with disabilities and late diagnosed neurodivergence, often recognising my own struggles in their experiences. I was also based in police custody and designing several mental health training packs for staff, which included autism and ADHD. And eventually, the penny dropped. I did an online assessment first of all, and it came back highly autistic traits. I then did many more with the same result. But even when I went for the autism assessment, I thought the consultant psychiatrist might just say no, leaving me with a cold reality that I might just be a jerk. Thankfully, that wasn't the case. She said I'd done incredibly well to get to where I had with the challenges I faced. It's hard to believe, though, that for 38 years, feeling out of place and abnormal becomes the uncomfortable norm. the confusion and the frustration just a really uncomfortable part of life. I paid for the assessment, having been told I could wait 7 years for one with a local service. Not all late discovered women have this option. Neither do late discovered men, but because of the way autism assessments are set up, there are many more late discovered women than men. At one time, it was thought to be a predominantly male condition. When looking at accessing an autism assessment, I got in contact with someone from our neurodiversity support network to discuss the options. Every policing area needs such a network, and if your police force or other organisation doesn't yet have one, it needs one. They were really helpful and directed me towards someone who had assessed police officers previously, which is a helpful angle because being a police officer adds a whole other identity dimension to being a woman and being neurodivergent. This person also suggested I might want to get assessed for ADHD from what he knew about me. I hadn't even considered ADHD due to my own misconceptions. The people with ADHD I saw coming through custody were on the whole dysregulated, bouncing off the walls, agitated, highly disorganised individuals. I slowly came to realise I would be more like that if I didn't have coping mechanisms in place. A lot of the memory problems, double booking myself, and need to always be busy were in fact ADHD symptoms. I just learned to manage them reasonably well from an early age through the exercise and having one place for all appointments and commitments, as well as lists as reminders of what I needed to do daily. I'd made my own adaptations without even knowing. Perhaps naively, I thought that diagnosis would be a revelation. To some extent, it has been. I'm much kinder to myself and able to laugh when I take things literally or don't get people's jokes or misunderstand, and that's been really important. But with other people, it's been very inconsistent. At the time I was diagnosed, I was in the completely wrong environment. I'd passed the police sergeant to detective sergeant process and was on the PIP 2 pathway, but not everyone agrees with bypassing being a detective constable. To make matters worse, I passed the inspector's board partway through the aide. Suddenly, detective inspector was in my line of sight, and the passion, drive and brutal honesty were on show for all to see. I was back in 2007, except this time it was two female DIs, and they knew I was autistic. It ended up with my confidence smashing rock bottom again, a spectacular meltdown at work, and me leaving the department. Luckily for me, I landed in a department where my autism and ADHD were embraced with open arms, and adjustments were made. I was treated with dignity and respect, and the people there carefully picked me up off the floor, put me back on my feet, and then supported and mentored me into a detective inspector role in the same department. Misogyny in policing is an issue, there's no denying it, but whilst I can give multiple examples of male perpetrated misogyny, I can give you many more examples of men supporting, mentoring and championing women. I have also demonstrated how women can be the worst offenders for doing their own gender's legs. Perhaps that's what survival looks like to them. I now have the privilege of working with some of the best detectives in the business, investigating crimes against the most vulnerable members of society, many of whom don't have a voice. I'm told I'm doing a really good job. I also love it and finally feel like I'm making the difference I've always wanted to. It's a round peg, round hole scenario and the best job I've done in 20 years. That ability to spot patterns and gaps translates well into the detective world. My management style ensures my staff are conducting quality investigations where the full range of available tactics are utilised to protect children and bring offenders to justice. I can be a bit like a dog with a bone. In terms of adjustments in my current role, I can mostly make them for myself. I've got my own office where I can control the environment to a certain extent. I have the time to create briefing documents on the bigger investigations, to put down all my thoughts and details about the investigation, which impresses my peers and managers, but actually is to reduce the cognitive load of briefing straight out of my head. It enables me to organise information in a way that works for me. In a post-COVID world, I have the technology to work from home sometimes to reduce social interaction and sensory overload. There is routine, there is flexibility. There are also lots of other neurodivergent staff. Whilst I can't prove it yet, I do believe there are higher numbers of neurodivergent individuals in certain roles, like investigation and problem-solving roles, due to our unique strengths and skills. I am very open with my team about my neurodivergence to secure understanding. Things like the fact I feel empathy differently, and they may have to nudge me to let me know a case is sad and upsetting them. In other ways, I feel things very deeply, often physically. But this empathy difference also protects me from experiencing trauma from the horrific and harrowing cases we deal with. I'm just very mindful it's a leadership blind spot at times, and one I need to overcome to ensure my team know I'm listening and that I care. I am to a certain extent open with others outside of my own team to try and gain understanding for better communication and relationships. I can't change, and trying to is not thriving. And whilst there's a duty on me to be open and gain understanding, this duty equally lies with others. To be effective leaders, we must both understand ourselves and be open-minded enough to get to know and understand others instead of jumping to a negative conclusion that because they are different from us, they are wrong or lesser and need to change. So how did I overcome the barriers to promotion to get into this privileged leadership position? Well, to some extent, I got lucky. I eventually found my name in front of an SMT, whereby more people liked Marmite than hated it. This element of Russian roulette-style luck needs to change, though. But for it to change, the culture within policing organisations in the UK needs to fundamentally change. It literally needs to move on its axis from where it currently is. The neurotypical needs to stop viewing the neurodivergent as wrong or less or flawed. To see us for who we are, the highly skilled, highly intelligent individuals with the other perspectives and ideas that might actually give policing the ability to get ahead of the curve, becoming the world-class sustainable organisation it aspires to. There's a reason why organisations like GCHQ and BAE Systems have specifically advertised to recruit autistic women, and this, I believe, is it. It wasn't just luck, though. Earlier in the blog, I said I'd never failed a CVF promotion board, but I have failed lots of PPF boards for lateral moves. Boards are set up by the neurotypical for the neurotypical. I spend an inordinate amount of time in my head. I find thinking a very enjoyable pastime and need time daily to do it to thrive. I come up with the most brilliant ideas and solutions, but translating them out of my head verbally in a sensical fashion, like in a board scenario, is problematic. Understanding promotion board questions is also problematic because of the tendency to read in a literal sense. Unlike in real life, there is no opportunity to check understanding or seek clarity. The public speaking issue, inability to understand the question, and inability to give a coherent response from all the beautiful content in my head has led to some absolute car crash experiences. Eventually, I worked out if I was going to get anywhere, I was going to have to overcome it, and reasonable adjustments weren't a thing then. Firstly, I had to overcome the public speaking issue. One of the problems was that as I went into a public speaking scenario, there would be a negative loop in my head. A torrent of internal abuse about what an idiot I was going to make of myself and how no one wanted to hear what I had to say. Simple solutions to simple problems. If you practice saying positive things to yourself in your head for long enough, the dialogue will change and you might even believe it. I eventually did. As well as this positive self-talk, I practiced deep breathing and grounding just before I went in, which are both scientifically proven to bring cortisol levels in the blood down and make you feel less anxious. Then I had to overcome the cognitive challenge of coherently taking what was in my head and delivering it verbally in a 40-minute promotion board, which is a sustained social interaction. I was given lots of models to try, but trying to remember the model was a challenge in itself. I finally landed on Simon Sinek's Golden Circle, and the rest is history, really. Simple but effective and made total sense to me. I've mentored numerous other people using these techniques, many of whom are neurodivergent and or struggle with anxiety, and so far have 100% pass rate. Feedback's still important for me, though, even from boards I've passed. Not only for my next one, but for my mentees. And there's still room for improvement. I've had feedback that I didn't seem to really understand some of the questions. Also that whilst I scored top marks on the first couple of questions, I then seemed to run out of steam. Well, as I said, it's a social interaction, but without the interaction. And after the first couple of questions, I'm done. Fortunately, now I can access reasonable adjustments to reduce the cognitive load. Things like getting the questions in advance to make sense of them and a break halfway through to recharge. Diagnosis does make access to reasonable adjustments easier, but most people don't know they are also available to those without a diagnosis. If you need something for whatever reason and what you're asking for is reasonable, I implore you to do so. Others who don't need adjustments may feel negatively towards them, but that's their issue to deal with. It's not cheating or gaining an unfair advantage. It's about putting ourselves on a level playing field with those that the test was specifically designed for. All we're doing is making the test more bespoke to our needs. so that we can showcase our skills, knowledge and experience in a way that plays to our strengths. But how does policing ensure other barriers are removed from neurodivergent candidates, other than by providing reasonable adjustments if they're lucky enough to get to a board? How do we encourage neurodivergent candidates to put their head above the parapet in the first place? Well, as I already said, it's going to require significant change. It isn't going to be easy. Adjustments are very individual. What I need as an autistic woman may be different from the next autistic person. It requires professional curiosity and a problem-solving approach. It requires a flexible approach to truly understand what someone needs and how this can be provided. Leaders must be willing to go outside the box. The "we've always done it that way, so you must do it that way" needs to be a thing of the past. There's also a saying, overtrained and undereducated. I don't believe we're going to train our way to a kinder, more understanding, more accepting organisation. Many will turn up to training but not actively incorporate the learning into their practice. Those who've chosen to serve in leadership positions should be displaying professional curiosity anyway, seeking out those with diverse needs in their teams, whether diagnosed or not, and proactively supporting and mentoring them. If not, it's a performance issue and needs to be dealt with. Ensuring more visible neurodivergence in all areas of the business, but especially in senior management positions, will also radically improve the situation. As uncomfortable as coming out as autistic is to start with, it is exactly why I've written the blog and recorded this podcast. Why I recently took part in a podcast for late discovered autistic women. To shine a light on those of us breaking barriers and making a significant positive contribution to our relevant areas of business or interest. And not despite our differences, but because of them.